Amen. Please do take a seat. And if you have managed to close your Bibles over, since Christine read to us those first couple of chapters of the song, you may want to have it open again. It does make more sense when you see it. The NIV's done a helpful job of actually laying it out and making sure you know who's saying which words. There's one or two places that we go through where I might suggest that they haven't got it quite right. But we'll deal with that when we get there. The Song of Songs. Chapter 1, verse 1. Solomon's Song of Songs. Right, let's just stop right there. Okay, Song of Songs. It's just a little way of constructing a sentence that the Bible has when it wants to talk about the supreme version of something. Right, so you think when we were going through Leviticus, right at the heart of the tabernacle, was the Holy of Holies. All right, that is like the supremely holy place in the whole tabernacle, in the whole world. When you think about the way in which Jesus is spoken of as the King of Kings, all right, you're like, yeah, okay, he's not just a king. He's like the king, he's the supreme king. He is the king over all other kings. He is the king from whom all other kings derive whatever authority and regality and splendor they may have. All right, this is the uber song. It is the song of songs. All right, it is the supreme song that has ever been written in the whole history of creation. All right, if there was a charts for all of time, this song has always been and will always be number one. It is the song of songs. Solomon, we're told in the Bible, wrote over 1,000 songs. This was his best. Of all the songs that have ever been written, this is the song that the lyrics of which should be running through our mind more than any other. And it's written by Solomon. Now, just pause for a moment and remember back to Solomon's lifestyle, particularly his sexual experience. Okay? How many wives did Solomon have? 700. 700. And as well as 700 wives, he also had a rather large number of other women that he was sexually involved with, but never kind of got round to marrying. So we're looking at a guy who, seems to have had over 1,000 sexual partners in his life. And yet here, this song that is describing and is celebrating faithful, committed, covenant love, expressed in the context of a marriage between one man and one woman that will last a lifetime, is written by a man who, at the end of time, may well prove to be the person who has sinned most catastrophically in the very area in which he is writing this song about. Isn't that interesting? Of all the people the Spirit could have inspired to write this song, he chooses Solomon. That is the grace of God. Nehemiah 13, we're told Solomon is still a man loved by his God. And I make that point because I want to establish an atmosphere of grace as we come into this book. Because whatever our experience of marriage and of sex and of sexuality, whatever our history, whatever grief, whatever disappointment, whatever frustration, whatever shame, whatever guilt we might be bringing to this book, I want you to hear the clear note of grace that sounds from the very first verse. If Solomon could write this book, believe me, whatever we've done, we can read it and we can hear God speak to us through it. It's not a closed book. We can learn through this part of the counsel of God. I'm going to make that point like that over and over again as we go through this series. Now, chapter 1, I'm not going to do this the whole way through, by the way. Chapter 1, verse 2. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. And that really sets the tone for this whole first section of the book. In fact, really, for the whole book. You've got, it's a song that is about a young woman who is getting ready for marriage. And right at the forefront of her mind is the guy that she's going to get married to. And she is completely, embarrassingly in love with him. And she desires him. She doesn't want, a phone call. She doesn't want to sit down and Skype this guy. She doesn't want a letter. She doesn't want a photograph. She wants him. She wants him right here, right now, up close, and very intimately. She wants the man that she loves. And really, the first couple of chapters of this book are just saturated with the desire that this woman has for this man. I mean, that is really the kind of where the emphasis of these opening chapters lie. She just cannot say enough to celebrate this guy. Your love is more delightful than wine. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfume. Your name is just like perfume poured out. This profound desire, this deep attraction, this longing to give herself to this man in marriage, to make herself vulnerable to him. I mean, it's incredibly intense. It's a little bit intimidating, and it is tainted with just a hint of insecurity and fear. She longs for this guy so much. And there is just this undercurrent, and we'll look at this, really comes to the fore next week. We'll look at this next week. There's this undercurrent of just deep insecurity. All right, the man that she has fallen in love with is Jerusalem's most eligible bachelor. Verse 3, no wonder the maidens love you. All right, this is the guy that every woman wants to get her hands on. All right, this is the guy everyone is talking about. He's the king. He's got everything going for him. He is literally the catch of the day. And she looks in the mirror and thinks, have I got what it takes to win this man's affections? Have I got what it takes to keep this guy's eyes on me, to capture his heart, his attention, and to hold it? She's deeply insecure. And part of it is because she knows she's been wounded by her own experience of her family. Look at chapter 1, verse 6. Don't stare at me, because I'm dark. I'm darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me take care of the vineyards, and my own vineyard I had to neglect. She looks at herself. She's a working class girl. She's a manual laborer in a vineyard. She has to work dawn to dusk, keeping food on the table, providing for the family. And it's not a happy family. And the damage that has been done by those family relationships, not being what they ought to be, has crippled her slightly as she looks to build a relationship with this man. She's just an ordinary girl. She doesn't have the big swish wardrobe. She doesn't have the time or the money for pedicures and manicures and beauty days at the spa, waxes and hairdos. She's plain, unsophisticated, uncultured. She's been exposed to the elements. It's damaged her skin, her appearance. And she feels all of this very keenly as she tries to capture the heart of the man she loves. She's scared. Don't look at me. I kind of want you to notice me, but I'm scared that if you do, you'll reject me. Now we're going to this, like I said, this is really the emphasis of next week's sermon. But we just need to see it just beginning to come to the surface, even in these very early moments of the book. Just the hesitation. Her desire for this guy is so intense, and yet she craves reassurance as she looks to enter into this relationship with this guy. Now, what I find interesting, given her insecurity, is that there is no desperation. She approaches this relationship with incredible dignity. She wants to be with this guy. Hang on. What? No. Oh, well, sorry. Tell him whom I love. Chapter 1, verse 7. Tell him whom I love. Where do you graze your flocks? Where do you rest your sheep at midday? And then she asks, why should I be like a veiled woman beside the flocks of your friends? Now, what's going on with this? She wants to be with, she wants to meet him from work for lunch. It's a very everyday kind of romantic thing. Even though he's working very, very far away, she wants to meet with him. Where is he? Where is his flocks? Where do you graze your flocks? Where do you rest your sheep so that I can come? But I don't want our relationship to be misconstrued. You know, think about it. She is, she's, like I said, a working class girl from as far down the socioeconomic spectrum and as far towards the other end of it as you could possibly get from King Solomon. And you can imagine how open to misinterpretation this relationship is. As she works to build this relationship, it could easily be misconstrued. She doesn't want to be, verse 7, like a veiled woman beside the flocks of your friends. She doesn't want his mates to be laughing at her. We all know what she's after. She doesn't want to be the butt of their jokes. She doesn't want other people looking in thinking she's just trying to take advantage of you. She doesn't want to be seen to be a veiled woman. Now, what's this about? Well, back in Genesis chapter 38, there's a pretty odd story which we're not going to get into at all tonight, except to say that there's a woman called Tamar who wants to trap a guy called Judah. And the way she does it is to dress up as a prostitute in order to seduce him, which she succeeds in doing. Now, what's interesting is that when Judah sees her, the thing that he picks up on, the thing that marks her out in his mind as a prostitute, is that she is wearing a veil. All right, to be a veiled woman is a euphemism for prostitution. It's the way we might speak of a lady of the night. And she said, look, I want to come, I want to be with you, but I don't want people to think that I'm in this for the payoff. That I'm giving myself to you in this relationship because of what you can give me in terms of money, in terms of lifestyle, in terms of status within society. She doesn't want him or his friends or anyone else to misinterpret what's going on as she pursues this guy. All right? She doesn't want to be thought of as a gold digger. Her whole thing is she's coming to Solomon and saying, look, I want you to know that I am in this relationship, not because of what I can get out of it, not because of the benefits that I will accrue by being married to you. I am in this relationship because I love you. and because my desire is for you. My affections are set on you. There's no agenda. I just love you. There's real dignity in that. Her insecurity is causing some problems, but there is a desire and a dignity to this woman as she approaches this relationship. Now, that insecurity is something that Solomon picks up on. And he doesn't say much in these opening couple of chapters, but what he does say is very much about encouraging her, reassuring her. He's working hard in this relationship to make sure that it is a place where she can feel safe, where she can feel secure, where she can be vulnerable to him. So this is what he says. This is his opening line of the book. Chapter 1, verse 9. All right? He's looking to combat her insecurity. I liken you, my darling, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariots. Sweetheart, you look like a horse. Now, Liz will tell you I am not the most romantic of guys. But even I can see how this could backfire. I'm not sure that this is really going to have the effect, the reassuring effect that she needs to hear from Solomon. Actually, it might not be as bad as it first sounds. In 1 Kings chapter 10, we're told that Solomon is the most powerful and the wealthiest king in the world. In his day, it says silver was as common as gravel in his kingdom. All right, he was kind of a one-man superpower, basically. He was phenomenally wealthy, may well turn out to be, relatively speaking, the wealthiest man who has ever lived. So he can get the best of anything in the world. And when it comes to horses, we're told, again in 1 Kings, that Egyptian horses are the best in the world. They are the most elegant, they are the swiftest, the most majestic, the most beautiful horses in the world, all come from Egypt. That's where Solomon goes to buy his horses. And Solomon turns to this woman who is to be his bride. He says, listen, out of the best horses in the world, it is only the very best of the best that are reserved for the purpose of pulling the chariots of Pharaoh. Now you might feel he's still got some work to do. But hopefully you can begin to see that this might actually be a compliment in its own slightly confused way. You are, of all women, the most beautiful, the most elegant, the most majestic. Chapter 1, verse 10. Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your neck with strings of jewels. She's working in a vineyard for a shekel a day. Where is she getting golden earrings from? Jewel necklaces. He's given them to her. He has adorned her with incredibly beautiful gifts. Not the price of a prostitute. Not with strings attached. But tokens of his love and his affection, reassuring her, inspiring her confidence. He wants her to feel safe in her relationship with him. He wants her to have assurance so that she can be vulnerable with him, so that she has the space to love him. He's working hard at giving her confidence and security and assurance, convincing her that he has set his love on her. And it works. There's this kind of flirty thing going on right the way through from verse 12 through to 16, 17, where they're just kind of like, basically it's a bit of romantic banter. It's like, oh, how beautiful you are, my darling. No, 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 you're really handsome. No, 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 you're really beautiful. It's a bit sickening, really, but, you know, it's the way they're doing it. And she's sitting there. She's put on the perfume that she knows he likes. She wants to be attractive. She wants to assault his senses. She wants to be the center of attention. But remember that insecurity don't stare at me. I want you to, but don't. Keeps poking its head through at the start of chapter 2. I'm just one common flower in the midst of a whole valley full of flowers. A rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. I don't understand why it is that you would pick me out, put your love and affection on me when there are so many other flowers that could catch your attention. And his immediate response is not to lose patience. Okay, he doesn't turn around and say, oh, for crying out loud, let's put this conversation again. Have we just had this? Look, I told you I loved you. If anything changes, I'll let you know. You know, no, that's not his attitude. All right, there's such a love for him. Look, no, so gentle, so tender, no impatience, no frustration, just, he loves her. And so he takes her expression of insecurity and turns it into something that, again, is designed to reassure her. You're a lily among thorns. Right? You are my darling amongst all the young. Yeah, there are. There's valleyfuls of flowers. There's plenty more fish in the sea. But you are the one I have chosen. You are the one I love. You are the one I want to marry. You are a lily among thorns. I desire you. And again, he's just giving her the confidence, the reassurance to open her heart, to articulate, to pour out her desire, her affection for this man. And what does he do in response? Is he like, great, I've said all the right things, and now she's putty in my hands, and I can get whatever I want? No, not at all. Chapter 2, verse 14. My dove in the clefts of the rock, in the hiding places of the mountainside. Show me your face. Let me hear your voice. Your voice is sweet. Your face is lovely. Isn't that incredible? Before he touches her body, he's reaching out to touch her soul. I want to look into your eyes. I want you to talk to me. I want to understand you. I want to hear what's going on in your heart, in your head. I want to listen to what you have to say. Before I touch your body, I touch your soul. And then verse 15. He's just soft, you see. I knew you'd like the picture. This catch for us, the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards, our vineyards that are in bloom. He is challenging her a little bit. He's taking responsibility for the relationship, and he's saying, look, I know, you know, there are things here that are going on, little issues that threaten, that could so easily undermine our relationship. These little foxes. You know, we've got something great going, and I love you, and I want to encourage you, and I want to reassure you, and I want to give you confidence and security in our relationship, but we do have to deal with the insecurity, because that's going to damage our relationship. It's going to fracture it. So we're going to hunt those things down, and we're going to deal with them. All right, we'll look again at that next week. But he does say, look, you know, I love you. He's not hammering her on this, but he is saying we do need to deal with it. So that's something of the dynamics of what's happening in these first couple of chapters. I like it. I like it a lot. I think it's beautiful. It's an amazing relationship that this song is celebrating, and it's allowing us to watch it develop before our eyes. And before we see through it, I want to say this really as a pastor. Isn't this the kind of relationship we would want our sons and daughters to be involved in? For the children who are growing up in this church, to be involved in relationships that have this level of integrity and dignity to them. This woman's incredible. She's not naive. She's self-aware. She understands what's going on within herself. In a way, she has been damaged by relationships in the past. She recognizes her fear, her insecurity, but she's not driven by that fear. She's not shaped by that insecurity so that she just jumps into the first relationship and does whatever it takes to keep this guy because she might not get another chance. The dignity in this woman is incredible. She comes to this relationship. She is taking initiative in it. She expects to be respected. She expects to be treated with dignity. She expects her relationship to be beyond reproach. She expects this man to defend her and to conduct himself in a way that means everyone can see that her integrity is not compromised. I would love the girls that grow up in our churches to approach relationships with that kind of an attitude. And for the guys, to grow up to be the kind of men that we see in these opening chapters, who before they touch a woman's body, want to reach out and touch her soul. Who aren't going into relationships to be manipulative, with only one thing on their minds, but who will invest in their relationship with this woman. They will not take advantage of the fact that they are the center of a woman's desire or attraction. Who will approach a relationship with respect and dignity, and who will, in the midst of that relationship, build a place of safety and security. Who will give their partner confidence and assurance and security that will allow her to bare her soul and to make herself vulnerable. As a pastor, let me just say, I want the children in our church to grow up having that taught to them and having that modeled for them. We have children in our church. That is not something today's age we should be taking for granted. And we have a responsibility to prepare our children. They're going to step out into a world that is frankly catastrophically confused around sex and sexuality, marriage, intimacy, covenant, commitment, respect. And they're going to have to negotiate that world, and I want them to go out from this church having seen what relationships should be like, having been taught what relationships would be like, how to enter into a relationship and to conduct that relationship in a way that is godly and in a way which will honor the Lord and the man and the woman who are in that relationship together. Now, we've looked at the relationship. Let's see through it. It's not just a romantic song, a story, fairy tale wedding. The dynamics of this relationship play out the way they do because they are reflecting the relationship between Christ, heavenly bridegroom, and his bride, the church. So we need to look at this relationship, recognize it for what it is, celebrate, learn from it, be challenged by it, but we need to see through it to the relationship Christ has with his church. Now, we're going to look, like I said, at the whole question of insecurity next week, because that is really what chapter 3 is all about. This week I want to look at these two words that I've stressed throughout, dignity and desire. These are the two words I want to pick up on that I've kind of highlighted from the drama of the first two chapters. I've wanted us to see the dignity with which this woman approaches her relationship because she represents the church. She she is the bride of Christ. And she comes to her bridegroom with an integrity that she wants to be publicly displayed. Now, this might sound strange, but I want to put it like this because I want it to stick in your mind. The bride of Christ does not want to be seen as a veiled woman. The bride of Christ must not be a spiritual prostitute. All right, think back to the woman in the song. She doesn't want to be misinterpreted as, you know, I am in this because I'm a gold digger, because you can give me a status, you can give me financial resources, you can give me kudos, you can, you know, she doesn't want that. I am in this relationship because I love you, not because of what you may or may not be able to give me. And I want to suggest that we need to work every bit as hard in our relationship with Christ to make sure that we are coming to Christ not because of what we want Him to give us, but simply because of our desire for Him and our love for Him. I love Christ. See, this is the danger, isn't it? We come and we sing the songs and we say the liturgy. I love Christ. I desire Christ. I set my affection on Christ. I rejoice in Christ. Yeah, but actually, there's an agenda. This is what I expect Christ to do for me if I worship Him, if I go to church. I'll be there, but what are you going to give me? See, this is the default setting of kind of the entire human religious enterprise. You know, I worship God because I want God to protect me. I want God to provide for me. I want God to give me health, to look after my family, to make sure I get the right job, to make sure that things work out for me in my life the way I want them to. And so it's so easy to bring that into Christianity and say, okay, God, I'm here and I'll pray and I'll worship and I'll do what you want, but there's something I want from you as well. Now, there are some brands, some versions of Christianity where this is just very explicit and it's very crass. And, you know, it is, you know, come to Jesus and He will make you healthy. Come to Jesus and He will give you financial resources. He will give you influence. He will make you prosper. But even if we're not buying into that explicit kind of distortion of the gospel, we can still so often have an unspoken agenda that we bring to our relationship with Christ. I love you. I desire you. I'll be in relationship with you. And this is what I want. And as a pastor, I know this because when things go wrong, one of the first questions Christians ask is, I thought you loved me. If you love me, why aren't you delivering on the unspoken agreement that we had when I started coming to church? Basically, it's a form of spiritual prostitution. I sell my worship to God because of what He will pay me, what He will give me, what He will do for me and for my family. And I will only worship God so long as He upholds His side of the bargain. It's what we see in the opening chapters of Job. Apparently, this is a really famous painting of that moment in Job where Satan comes before God and says, yeah, have you seen Job? He only worships you because you have blessed him. You've made him rich. You've given him a family. You've made his business prosper. That's why he worships you. If you take all that away, then he won't worship you anymore. Right? Satan knows how we think. He knows how we work. And so he comes to Job, and that's his accusation. You are only a Christian because what you want. You're only interested in the king because of the status and the kudos and the lifestyle and the money and the resources that you will get by being in relationship with him. And she has worked so hard at making sure that is not the situation. That's not what's going on. No, I am here because I love you. I desire you. I have set my heart on you. I am in this relationship for you, not for what you can do for me. It's, I think, incredibly challenging. It sends us back to examine our hearts, to explore our souls and our relationship with God. Do we desire Christ for himself, for his own glory, for his own person? Yeah, and when we see the image of Christ that is set before us in the scriptures, in a way, it's like, well, how could we not? You know, he is the ultimately desirable. He is, you know, the desire of all nations. He is the God who has set his love on us. He is a God who has been gracious to us, a God who has been compassionate, merciful. He is a God who has given his very life to be in relationship with us. He is a God who is pure, who is righteous. He is total integrity. There is no shadow of turning or dishonesty or deceit. He is glorious and majestic and almighty. And there's a part of me that wants to say, what is there to not desire in him? Wherever we live, whenever we live, whatever culture we're a part of, whatever nation we have been born into, he is the desire of all nations. It's the great unchangeable reality of all creation. He is desirable. And we are to desire him for who he is. It's why Job's confession is so profound. Whether you give or whether you take away, blessed be the name of the Lord. I give you my heart. Because I'm not in this for what I get out of it. I'm not in this because of what blessings you may or may not give me. I am in this because I love you. I desire you. That is what must shape our worship and our discipleship. But in order to do that, we need Christ to be like the bridegroom in the Song of Songs. We need him to be at work building into our relationship with him the security and the confidence and the safety that allows us to be that kind of church. And, you know, we'll hear him say, look, I know you, my bride, you are bringing issues into this relationship, but I promise you we will deal with them. There will be security, there will be assurance, there will be confidence that will allow you to be vulnerable to me. It will allow our relationship to be genuine and authentic. It will be a place where we can learn to focus our desire on our heavenly bridegroom for who he is. Now this might sound strange, but worship is the most terrifying thing any human being can ever do. When we enter worship, what we're saying is this. We're saying, Jesus, in you, I have found someone who is so intrinsically and inherently worthy that you are worth me giving my everything for you. You are worth me living for. You are worth me dying for. You are worth me spending my time, my money, my energy, my gifts, my power, my abilities on you. Worship is saying, I am willing to give everything for you because in you I have found one who is worthy of all that I am. To do that, we need to have absolute confidence that our heavenly bridegroom is the desire of all nations, the one worthy of our desire and our worship, that he is worth me taking all my hopes, all my ambitions, all my dreams, all my desires, everything that I want in my life, to be about, putting it all to one side and saying, none of that is worth me living for compared to what I have found in you. Worship is terrifying because it is death to self. And we will not be able to do that unless our heavenly bridegroom has invested in us, reassured us, spoken to our hearts again and again, patiently, tenderly, gently, lovingly. I have chosen you. I have loved you. I have set my affection on you. I desire you. I delight in you. I rejoice over you. And he will have to come back again and again and again. When we look in the mirror and we become so acutely aware of how unworthy we are, he will need to come back again and convince us again. I have chosen you. I have loved you. I desire you. I delight in you. I have set my affection on you. I rejoice over you. And it is only when we are truly confident and safe and secure that we will be able to make ourselves vulnerable in authentic worship. Only then will we be able to orient ourselves towards him. Not because of what we hope he will give us, but just because who he is. Then, and only then, will I be truly shaped, defined by my desire